Welcome to The B-Word, a podcast about humans, organizations, behavior. I'm your host, James Healy.
A lot happened in the summer of 69.
Apollo 11 put a man on the moon. The world's first ATM was installed at a bank branch in Long Island, New York. And if you believe the song lyrics, a young Canadian named Brian Adams bought his first guitar at a five and dime. That same year, a Swiss-American psychologist named Elizabeth Kubler-Ross published a book, On Death and Dying, which outlined the five stages of grief. Based on interviews with patients who'd recently received a terminal diagnosis, Kubler-Ross identified denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance as the five stages of emotional response to a medical death sentence. The concept was rapidly adopted by the burgeoning field of organizational change management, and the five stages were visualized in what will become known as the change curve. A lot has changed since 1969, but to say that Kubler-Ross's model is still popular with organizations would be a wild understatement. But is it true? Is it useful? Spoiler alert. Of course it's not. It's plainly ridiculous to assume that finding out your employer is implementing a new system or changing the org structure is actually like being told you're dying. I've been on some difficult projects in my time, but seriously, nobody thinks a new SAP system is really like a death sentence. Now, this might seem like a somewhat niche concern, but it's just one example of a much broader trend. So much of the conventional wisdom that underpins organizational approaches to change, culture, leadership, learning, frankly, pretty much anything to do with humans, is dubious at best, if not downright nonsense. Today's guest, Paul Gibbons, has some fairly strong views on the change curve, and a range of other organizational sacred cows too, from learning styles to the Myers-Briggs type indicator. Paul's four-decade-long career spans business and academia. He's advised executives on change, leadership, and strategy at clients across a range of industries, including banking, oil and gas, airlines, telecoms, retail, and government. Paul's research and writing explore how philosophy and science can be used to enlighten contemporary business thinking, debunk myth and pseudoscience, and solve practical business problems, including changing culture, developing leaders, and using analytics and evidence to make strategic decisions. Paul's the author of numerous books, including The Science of Organizational Change, Impact, 21st Century Change Management, Behavioral Science, Digital Transformation, and the Future of Work, and Change Myths, the main topic of today's conversation. Paul, good morning, good evening. Welcome.
And James, hello.
Thanks for joining me.
Well, we couldn't be further away, mate. I mean, we're opposite sides of the planet.
The wonder of modern technology.
Isn't it splendid? Isn't it splendid? Good, good, good. So what should we talk about?
So, well, you've got a new book out. Why don't we start by talking about the new book and some of the myths that pervade the art or science, depending on your perspective, of change management?
Oh, well, I couldn't possibly talk about my book. Oh, no. What author? Yeah, it came out less than a week ago. I'll tell you the background. I was writing The Science of Organizational Change in 2013. I'd always want to write a book, but the thing is, I'd never thought that I could write a book that I would want to read, because so many books on management and leadership and culture and everything like that were such rubbish. In the 1990s, when I was learning my craft in change management, I must have read 100 of them, and then there were only five that I thought today are worth keeping. The fifth discipline is one that no one seems to read anymore, which I thought was transformational for me. So I set out to write this book, and I was reading Thinking Fast and Slow, Predictably Irrational. Then I read a lot of nonfiction, and I was reading it, and I thought, holy moly, I'll try not to swear. Holy moly, no one is talking about behavioral science and change management and culture change. And that was eminently the case in 2013. I don't think anybody was. And that became really my passion. So there are two or three chapters in The Science of Organizational Change on behavioral science. And it was more me saying, oh, look, there's a shiny stuff over here and it's super interesting. But I wouldn't really point to any case studies where I didn't know of any use cases inside organizations like the work you're doing on culture change or in learning or, you know, any of the other kind of use cases that might be deployed inside organizations. So it was kind of more like a fantasy of mine. And of course, the world has changed. There are lots of people thinking about and a smaller number of people like yourself doing work inside organizations applying behavioral science. And that was that book. But one of the things I stumbled across when I was writing that book, because I started to think about change myths when I was writing the book, and I went to Amazon, which is one of my research tools, and typed in psychology myths, and a book popped up called The 50 Myths of Popular Psychology. And for listeners who are interested in the way that pop psychology kind of misrepresents or markets untruths about human beings, this is the one. Because each of these treatments is about, say, 4 to 6 pages long. There are 50 of them. And each of them says, well, this is what people seem to think. For example, abstinence is the only way to combat addiction. Or the one that we'll maybe talk about in a minute, or people who grieve, or people who are going through transition inevitably experience 5 or 6 stages of grief, similar to the experience of the dying. And another one in there was learning styles, and so on. And there are 50 of them. And I don't know, try to be brief, but the scales fell from my eyes because I've been a change guy since 1995, roughly, 94, 95. I'd had this kind of epiphany in my professional life. And one of the first things I learned was denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. That was literally like model number one, slide number one, day number one of how you become a change person. And then later on in that, we learned about learning styles, which was a big thing then and now, which is in a huge industry. Now, and learn that people have different preferred ways of receiving content. Ha, who knew? But that if you tailor content to their preference, they learn better and faster. More on that later. And so when I read the 50 Myths of Popular Psychology, there were quite a few things that are part of the change canon. Another goodie is the Malcolm Gladwell, I think he popularized the 10,000 hour rule.
That's very popular.
It is. You know why it's popular? Because it basically says it doesn't quite say this, but it says there's no such thing as talent, right? It's all if you put the 10,000 repetitions in, you can be Michael Jordan or Magnus Carlsen or whomever. And it just ain't so. And of course, people have tested that. I think you know this, right? I think you and I have discussed this research before, and that talent is a significant part of what people who could be called great, Magnus Carlsen, Michael Jordan. And yes, they put the 10,000 hours in, maybe much more than that. But they're also, you know, Tiger Woods allegedly had a perfect golf swing when he was 4. You know,
that's a lot of hours to put in before you're 4. I think.
Well, his daddy was obsessive about his son becoming a golfer. But the people who are the best in the world at chess are, you know, I mean, I think there were two women who were Hungarian or Bulgarian grandmasters, the Polgar sisters, who were grandmasters before their 10th birthday. Now, it's not possible for them to have put in 10,000 hours before their 10th birthday, I don't think. And it's like many of these things, it's seductive because it says that there aren't, you know, differences between people and ability, that we can all be great if we put the hours in, which is sadly not the case. I'm never going to be a ballet dancer, 10,000 hours or not. Never could have been. Your listeners can't see me. That would be funny if they could see my physique.
Yeah, so I'm wishing we had visuals at this point.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, this guy made the ballet dancer. So the scales kind of fell from my eyes, and I really, not for the first time in my career, I kind of felt like a charlatan. Like I've been peddling stuff which I'm reading a convincing account of says is rubbish. So anyway, Change Myths was born in 2015 as an idea, and there were like 20 of them in the Science of Organizational Change. I bumped into this other guy on LinkedIn who had a list of 20 as well, and we got together and knocked our heads together, started the book. He eventually said, life's too short, mate. I want to go back and earn a living. This writing stuff's not for me. So I started working with a woman called Trisha Kennedy, who lives in Texas, fabulous lass, and she became my co-author, and we've just finished it. So that's Changemas, and super excited about it. I think it's going to piss people off, though, James.
Isn't that the point?
Well, yeah, if you don't want to make money, that's the point. you see these things that get 1,000 or 2,000 or 5,000 likes on LinkedIn, right? And they're things that not always, sometimes are just like really, really rubbish and really, really nonsense and really, really... I don't mind simplifications because LinkedIn, doesn't really, you don't want thesis length content on LinkedIn. So everything has to be simplified, but simplified to the point of ridiculousness. Anyway, so that's the stuff that gets lots and lots of clicks. What doesn't get a lot of clicks is when you say, an example in one book, you'll know this, sugar makes children hyper. And you're at a dinner party and you're sitting with another grown up, the children are down the end running around in the garden and they're causing havoc because that's what six-year-olds do. And one of the dads turns to you and he says, look at those kids go. They've had too much sugar. And you, because you're a smart, if I may swear, arsehole of a guy, say, well, actually, there's no correlation between the amount of sugar children eat and their hyperactivity. And the guy looks at you as if like, who is this P word? People don't really appreciate that stuff being debunked. It happens too with things like astrology. I've had people say, what's your star sign? I say, I would prefer not to know, but if you need to know, really, it's a Libra. But that stuff's rubbish. There's no correlation between the position of the stars and your personality or your destiny. And I'm like, why did you have to say that? And they just think you're a dick, which, in a kind of way you are, right? People don't like to have that stuff doing. And then when people's professional identity is wrapped up in things like, I know one of the things that you've talked about in our chapter is the values-driven approach to culture change, what I call assess and egress. You do these questionnaires and ask people what they think their values are. I don't want to be political, but if you ask Donald Trump what he thinks his values are, he'd say honesty, probity, forthrightness, authenticity, respect for women. I mean, he would say lots of things that most people, apart from his support, would say that's patently rubbish. Those aren't your values. There's what you think your values are, or what you'd like the world to think your values are, but your behavior is the opposite of that. Anyway, I've rambled on, but that was the epiphany for me that birthed Change Myths was like, I was talking a lot of rubbish. And I was supposed to be like, I was like a managing consultant or director at PricewaterhouseCoopers. I was supposed to know my shit. And I did it. Anyway, what do you make of all of that? I've rambled on for too long. But anyway, that's the history of this whole malarkey.
Look, we can dig into a few of those myths. And I know you and I have talked about some of them before, but I think it's a good conversation to have. I think before we do that, the thing I would say is often there is a comfort in doing something. And it's what I call the Bob Geldof effect. Mm. And I'll explain that in a moment. I'm sure you're familiar with Bob Geldof. Some of our listeners of a younger generation may not be. Bob Geldof was a sort of middling rock star in the late 70s who had one hit, who reinvented himself as a campaigner for mostly Africa. So he was the driving force behind Live Aid in 1984. He's responsible for the Band Aid Christmas song that gets rolled out every year. Do they know it's Christmas?
Yes.
But in the mid 2000s, he changed his focus from famine in Ethiopia and general poverty in Africa to third world debt. and he was pushing for the IMF and other sort of international lending bodies to essentially write off all of the debt that was owed by African nations. And I vividly remember this interview he did. I think it was on the BBC. It was before the G8 summit at Gleneagles. And he has this phrase that he used, and it's always stuck with me. He said, "We need to do something. We need to do anything. Even if it doesn't work, just do something." And it precisely sums up this very common driving force, this very common bias that we have as humans towards activity. It doesn't really matter if what we're doing doesn't work, but we're doing something about it. We can say we're doing something about it, and it looks like we're taking it seriously. And for me, that Bob Geldof effect drives so much, or explains so much, of what happens in organizations. It doesn't really matter if it doesn't work, as long as we can show that we're doing something.
That's right.
And I think that underpins a lot of culture work. It certainly underpins a lot of change management, which is where we're going to go now. You mentioned briefly my personal favorite, the five stages of grief. Now, I can't think of a psychological idea which has gained as much popular traction as this. For a recent episode of this podcast, I was digging into the sitcom Friends for reasons that will become apparent when you listen to that episode with Robin Dunbar. But one of the Friends episodes, apparently one of the most watched Friends episodes ever, is called The Five Stages of Breakup. And this originally fairly obscure psychological concept has entered popular consciousness to such an extent that it inspired a whole episode of Friends. So
there you go.
Everyone knows it.
That's
everyone believes it.
The apex of fame. That's the apex of legitimacy. It's on Friends.
So who could possibly challenge this concept?
She was an incredible woman. Her book was called, the subtitle of her book was called On Death and Dying. Most people already know that, 1966 or 7 or something like that.
And nine, I believe.
Nine, if you wish. Yes, go on then. And the subtitle was What the Dying Have to Teach Nurses, Clergy, Doctors, and the Rest of Us, or something like that. And what she did was, and it's hard to realize how important her work was, is that just talking to people who were dying, first of all, she had a hell of a time getting permission to talk to them, first of all. But secondly, it was commonplace in those days to withhold diagnoses from family and even from the person who was terminally ill. So to soft pedal or to even misrepresent. The dying were shunted off to corners of hospitals called hopeless patients. But the ideas of, you know, end of life care, palliative care, the hospice movement, all of the sorts of things that we sort of take for granted today, living wills, all of that. You know, she gave birth to all of that basically through giving a voice to people who are at the end of their life. And she did create this great model, you know, DABDA, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. It was picked up by people like Virginia Satir later on. But apparently she was horrified that it was extrapolated. So she interviewed the dying. So first of all, this is the sort of history of that idea. She interviewed the dying, and this was the framework that she came up with. And in a minute, I'll tell you whether it applies to the dying. But she did say this doesn't apply to the grieving, so their families. She said it was about the dying and not the grieving. But then it went from the grieving people to loss generally. And there's a great book on organizational change called William Bridges Transitions, something like that, which essentially posits that all change involves loss. Ergo, because it involves loss, it involves a grief process. And, oh, look, there's this research from 1969 that says the grief process looks like this. And so now, and she had a following. I mean, she had 19 honorary degrees, if I recall the chapter of the book. She was on everyone's list of one of the most important psychologists of the 20th century, you know, like top 20. like up with Freud and Adler and Jung J.B. Watson and B.F. Skinner. And, you know, she's on that list of people who are leading lights of 20th century in psychology. And so she did a magnificent job of one aspect of her work was to give a voice to the dying and give birth to a change in the culture of how we relate to the dying. That's magnificent. So the question is does DABDA stand up now? And so in writing the book, I went out to study, look at the research on grieving and people who are experts in grief today, it's a much studied phenomenon to say there's no template for how we grieve. There is no universal template that applies to the particularity. Some people feel relief. Some people feel confusion. Some people feel numbness. There are a very complex process. Why those five? Are they the most important? Apparently not. Do they apply universally to grief? And then someone even tried to do research as to what percentage of the grieving process is applied by DABDA. And for it to be generally applicable, you thought, well, you want it to be right about half the time. And if I remember the research, it's 17% of the time that the grieving process will mirror DABDA. So not only is it not true for the dying, it's not a template for grief generally, grief experts say. And then you come to the really sort of quite ridiculous thing is how do we make the jump to organizational change? And you know, back in the day of organizational change, it would have been the mid-1980s or late 1980s, the people who were pioneers, Cotter and Connor are two names that spring to mind, needed a template for the psychological event of organizational change. And this is the one they jumped on. And that's why I learned it in 1994 or 1995. Now, whether that applies to a new CRM system or departmental reorganization or the implementation of, you know, Workday or some big technology thing, you know, why should it? Why should we make the leap between dying people and change? So what people will say, how they defend it, and by the way, there are people who defend this to the death on LinkedIn. They'll say it helps me empathize. And my question is like, well, does it? Does empathy require that you have a preconceived notion of what this person might be going through? Or is real empathy, real listening, real understanding, more like letting go of that and hearing what's being said and not trying to retrofit it to a template? So I would say it's harmful. It harms empathy rather than enables empathy. I would say it's false because it doesn't apply to the dying. And not only does it not apply to the dying, it doesn't apply to the grieving, and it doesn't apply to loss generally, and it certainly doesn't apply to putting in a CRM system. You know, I mean, it sounds ridiculous when you put it that way. And so anyway, that's the story of death and dying. And one of the other things that comes out in the Change Myths book is there's this notion abundantly in the change world is that change is difficult. Change is hard. And a no lesser famous person, is he Australian? David Rock? The neuroscience and organizational change.
I think he is.
I think he's Aussie. You know, world famous. I mean, there's probably no bigger name in the neuroscience, in the popularization of neuroscience as applied to organizations and leadership than David Rock. I think IBM pays him a shit ton of money every year as a, you know, an advisor. And he wrote an article for a magazine called Strategy and Business, which is PwC's kind of thought leadership magazine called Brains Hate Change. And he wrote it with a guy called Jeffrey Schwartz, who's an esteemed neuroscientist from the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA. And they wrote this article for S&B called Brains Hate Change. And the book has a chapter on why that's most puerile nonsense. Not that everything David Rock said is nonsense. I think Scarf is interesting. I think his ages framework is interesting. You know, he's certainly done a lot to legitimize more to legitimize the use of neuroscience in understanding organizations than anyone else. And so it's not surprising, given the scale of that task, that he got a few things wrong. Anyway, this is one thing he's got wrong. But what's the consequence of this? Why aren't these models harmless? Why isn't DABDA harmless? Why isn't brains hate change harmless? Why isn't the notion of resistance to change? Why aren't these harmless notions? And I'll tell you why. One of the reasons why is that the idea that change is by necessity difficult, and we know that change is sometimes difficult, but it's by necessity, in a sense, allows people who lead change, who orchestrate change, who initiate change, it almost gives them a get out of jail free card, because it points the telescope the wrong way. And it can, it's a sort of almost allows a sort of fatalism. Like, oh, we've got the system going in, and of course people are struggling, and of course they're pissed off, and of course the attrition numbers are going up. Well, no, nobody, no. There are ways to do these things. That doesn't mean the change has to be a shit show. You know, it's not inevitable. And guess whose responsibility it is for not making it inevitable? It's you. So the telescope is in a sense pointing the wrong way on the suckers who are at the other end of the change process, rather than back at me, is what can I be doing from the get-go to make this something that is an opportunity for people? How can I architect the change? You know, how can I structure the change? How can I plan the change? How can I involve people more deeply from the beginning in the change? You know, all of these big questions, what kind of change is more difficult? What kind of change processes work better? By living in this fatalistic, like change is hard world, I think it prevents leaders from doing the job that they ought to be doing, which is getting it right from the start. Now, is that easy? No, it's easy to be glib about that. But I do think we don't ought not to live in a world where things are inevitably difficult. And it's trivially easy to come up with examples of change in one's life. You got promoted. You moved to Australia from England, did you not?
Via Singapore, but yes.
Yeah, I mean, things were hard and things were not. I moved to the United States. Things were hard and things were easy. I mean, it's you know, we've all gone through big transitions, some of which have sucked and some of which have been magnificently wonderful. The birth of a child, you know. That's about as big a change. Getting married, that's about as big a change as one can go through, is getting married and entering a domestic partnership with someone. Having a child is about as big a change as, you know, one can have in one's life. Is that, you know, hard, difficult? Do our brains hate change? Does our nucleus accumbens, you know, does our amygdala screech in agony? You know, no. So we have these generalizations that I think are unhelpful, and they don't provide useful guidance to the people who are architecting and leading change. I don't think they provide useful guidance to change practitioners. So anyway, I've rambled on and on. I think I've spoken. We've been on for 25 minutes. I think I've spoken for 24 and a half of them. What are your reflections back there? You can tell I've just written a book, right? A diary of the mouth. But anyway, what do you think of all that?
Look, we've talked about a lot of this before, Paul, and I wholeheartedly agree. Part of me dies a little bit every time I see the change curve. When you say there are lots of people out there who defend it, you are absolutely correct. I have just Googled to get an update number on this, but if you Google change curve, at least with my combination of Google search history, it generates approximately 964 million results.
Which, that's great. That's great, isn't it?
You know, I think it's fair to say that the change curve is not even close to extinct. But I completely agree about the harm that it does, because it has pervaded almost everything that is done in organizational change. It has perpetuated this idea, as you say, that change is negative and that change is hard. And if you think about the language that is so often used in change management, it has a negative slant. We talk about change impacts. We talk about mitigating change.
Yep.
I've always found it completely perverse that an organization might be spending $100 million on implementing a new system, and then they pay someone like me to desperately help them to mitigate the impact of that. If you're spending $100 million, surely you want some impact. Isn't that the point?
Yeah. Fascinating.
And whenever I hear the word change fatigue, I always have to bite my tongue to not be that guy at the lunch correcting people about the lack of impact of sugar on kids. And I have to stop myself from saying they're not fatigued with change. They're fatigued by inept management. The reason they're cynical is because they've seen a bunch of other initiatives that have been completely botched and didn't make sense and weren't for their benefit. It's not because things are changing. It's because you've changed them badly in the past.
Yes. Very good. Very, very, very good. I haven't put it that way myself. I think that's a really, really good articulation. Very, very good. But I've often wondered, and I think you and I have been, in our chats, have been honest with each other. From my very first consulting project, which was a strategy project, where the client did nothing with our $4 million report. You know, I mean, they loved it and they paid the bill and they said, this is fantastic and exactly what we wanted. And they weren't able to do anything with it, which is kind of partly what propelled me into change. It's like, when are people going to blow the whistle on consultants for writing very expensive analyses and then popping off to the next client saying, good luck with that, mate. Let's, you know, let us know if you need something else. That was an epiphany for me in 1994. There was also, I did a master's in organizational behavior when I was 36. That's a really long time ago, by the way, for your listeners, like 30 years ago almost. We were looking at a subject called training transfer, which is the study of how training, organizational training, management training, skills training, the sort of stuff I made my living doing stuff like this for a long time. How much of it transfers to the job. And there was a not very, very well validated statistic, but I don't think it's a million miles wrong, which is, for your listeners who are nerds, it's called Jorgensen 1981. You can Google that. Only 10% of management skills training transfers to the job. And I was in the training business then, you know, I was at PwC, I was doing leadership training, was most of what I was doing. And I thought, when are they going to blow the effing whistle on us? Like, the global corporate learning business is, I think it's about $100 billion. 10% transfers to the job? I mean, are we setting fire? I mean, can we do better than that? And we don't really look at the modality of how we teach people in organizations, because you know why? Where did we learn it? We learned it from mass education. The problem of the Industrial Revolution and in the 20th century is, how do you teach? Well, I don't know how many children there are in the United States. Call it 50 million children in the United States. I'm pulling that out of my backside. But let's say it's about that. How do you prepare them for the workforce? And how do you prepare them for a workforce that, you know, requires a lot of white collar skills? Well, you sit them in a classroom for 13 years, and then they go to uni, and you sit them in a classroom for another 4 years. So you sit them in a classroom for 17 years, and you hope that some of it sticks, and you hope that they're earnest enough in the way they study it that they can apply it to what they're, you know, they decide to do with their lives. And, well, you know, that's what corporations inherited when the corporate training market was born, which is, I would guess, sometime in the middle of the 20th century. I don't think it doesn't work terrifically well for kids, but it keeps them from getting run over by cars, and it allows mom and dad to go to work. So there's some benefit to it. And they do learn something. So I don't want to be super, super critical of the school system, but that's what that we inherited when we began to design corporate training. And it's a very efficient way of putting, you know, dozens of people in a room and teaching them something. Does it work? Well, nobody gives a shit whether it works or not. We've got the bums on the seats. Look, we checked the boxes. We said that we would train 1,000 people in how to have a performance management conversation or in some sort of aspect of leadership. We did it with 1,000 people. We had 1,000 bums on seats. And look, we asked them how happy they were afterwards. Look at this. We got 4.6 out of 5. Or today it would be the net promoter score. Yeah, not entirely happy sheets, which is a very slight improvement, if any improvement at all. And you know what else the research on training transfer shows? There's almost no relationship between how happy people are and how much they learn. You know, once you've been doing corporate training for a long time, you're very good at entertaining. If you're doing motivational speaking, you're very good at making people laugh and appealing to their noblest sentiments. And, you know, who hasn't left a motivational speech feeling like the sugar high, to use that analogy again, of that? And then, you know, we have to ask the question, you know, been to the conference, you heard the motivational speech from Anthony Robbins or Simon Sinek or, you know, whoever. How much of that are you applying on Monday morning when you arrive back at work and your inbox is stuffed solid and your boss says, I want this by yesterday, mate, get to it. You know, not a lot. So, yeah. So my real fear with consulting, and this will lead us into behavioral science, which is kind of one of your topics as well, is that we're wasting clients' money and people's time rather more than we ought to. And the training world, I would say, it may even have taken a step back, but that's another conversation during the pandemic. You know, the shift to entirely virtual training is good in some respects because it saves a ton of money. So that $100 billion may be half that because you're not flying people around the planet, spewing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere to have them sit in the virtual classroom. We got virtual classrooms. Okay, well, that's an improvement in some regards. But I don't know if it's an improvement on training uptake. So, and I haven't seen any research, maybe you have, of if someone attends a virtual course on, I don't know, Agile, let's say, right? Is that better or worse than doing it in person? And when you evaluate transfer of training results to the job? I don't know. I'm curious. I haven't researched it. Have you? You know anybody that's researched like the effectiveness of things like Agile training, relative to live?
No, I don't have anything recent that springs to mind.
I bet you it's worse. I bet you it's worse.
Yeah, I bet that would be my hypothesis too.
Yeah.
When I think about training, I think so. I completely agree about the rates of knowledge transfer and the rates of knowledge retention. I often wonder, and this applies in the university context as well, not just in a corporate context. But I often wonder if sometimes we lose sight of what it is that we're actually trying to achieve with training, what it is that's actually being sold. And I think it's more than just the knowledge transfer. I think often, as you've kind of alluded to, there's an element of rewarding people or giving them a nice day out. And that's part of it.
And that's cool. I don't dispute that that's not the value that we say that we're paying for, but that's an indirect benefit, an indirect goodie. Training as reward, training as an enhancement of the user the employee experience. I completely agree, and that's not illegitimate by any stretch of the imagination. I don't think.
No, and there's the networking element, the relationship building.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then there's, depending on what the training is, there's also the signaling. And this certainly applies to universities, right? What are you essentially buying with a university degree? Is it 3 years of introspection and growth and knowledge, or is it a network and a piece of cardboard at the end with the with the right emblem on it?
The latter.
Yeah.
I mean, what was your degree in?
I think you know this. My undergrad was in philosophy and my master's was in history of international relations.
Yes, both. Good. And you use those almost every day, right? In every meeting, right? Of course. And mine was in biochemistry and neuroscience. Yeah, I use them almost never in 40 years. Now, that doesn't mean I'm unhappy with those 4 years. They were some of the greatest 4 years of my life. And the sort of having learned, you know, the intricacies of biochemistry and, you know, how human physiology works at a sort of molecular level, fascinating. I mean, you know, I'm glad I know that stuff. Is it useful? No, not the slightest, but I'm glad I went through it. And I learned to think. I learned to think critically about things. And I learned to study and apply my arse to the seat of a chair to pass exams, which is a useful faculty to be able to apply your arse to the seat when you want to write a book or you need to write a proposal or you need to get something out for a client. Like being able to apply your arse to the seat of a chair is a very useful skill. But anyway, yeah. But that gets us to the B word anyway, because I mean, this is called the B word. So, I mean, that's the bit that I think, you know, we're at the dawn of perhaps an answer to some of these problems that I've faced my whole career, which is the strategy report that I did for Barclays in 1993, which charged $4 million. They did nothing with. What would they have done with it? Well, there would have been some different behaviors, right? And a lot of what we do in change management is based on the cognitive psychology paradigm, which is change your insides to change your outsides. In other words, if you change someone's beliefs, perceptions, and attitudes, the behaviors follow. They don't. They don't. We know that. And so I think we're possibly at the dawn of a new world, and we haven't even begun to taste the nectar of how much behavioral science can influence learning and development in organizations. I think that's really ripe for change. $100 billion business. And there's there's a lot of people making their money doing that. There are behemoth consulting firms that do nothing but bums on seats training. There's a lot of people who have invested their entire careers in delivering knowledge to workers in that way. How many of them are willing to say, well, I really fucked this up. I mean, my whole career is a write-off. You know, God, I wish you'd said this to me 29 years ago. Not likely. You know, there's a lot of sunk cost and a lot of infrastructure built. I mean, IBM has, and I'm sure Deloitte's the same way, has the most impressive array of training courses available virtually that I've ever seen in my entire life. And I tried to ask IBM, like, what's the take up of them? Because, you know, just because the trough is there doesn't mean that the horse goes to drink from it or approaches it. And this is a terrible metaphor, but, you know, you can even if you lead it to the trough, it doesn't mean that it will drink, right? You know, lead the horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And then what's the take up of the virtual training? Like, how many people attend? And then what's the take up of knowledge transfer to the workplace? Well, I would love to see some numbers, but I doubt we've improved upon that dismal number from 1981, 10% of training transfers to the job. I doubt the virtual world has improved that number, because when you're on a virtual course, if it's delivered like it's a series of videos that you watch, it's just very easy to tune out. I mean, who hasn't? I've got the training course on over there. I'm doing something else on the other screen, right? I mean, even retention, which is one of the minimal things that you would want, is you want people to remember it. I mean, that's like necessary, but insufficient, right? Anyway, so I think behavioral science, the B word, as you've called it, is really the answer to a lot of things that we've been getting wrong for, you know, call it a century. So how do we do that, huh?
Well, I think so much comes down to the point that you made there, that the usual assumption with this stuff is that if you change attitudes, you change beliefs, you will change behavior. And that as an assumption underpins not just change management, it underpins the way that the vast majority of humans understand other humans. It is an utterly fundamental assumption to the way that human relationships and human society works. And I sound rather presumptuous saying this, it's not based on fact. And I think a couple of points I'd make, it's virtually impossible to change someone's attitude just by communicating to them. And if you're listening to this and you find that a somewhat confronting or challenging thing to hear, I'd urge you to just venture online for 5 minutes, go on your favorite social media site or your favorite news site,
And try and change someone's mind.
Yes, exactly. Just wade into the comments section underneath any newspaper article on any topic and find some people with a difference of opinion from you, which won't be hard, and explain to them in a few sentences why they're wrong. And let me know how that goes for you. It's virtually impossible to change someone's mind on any topic in which they're even remotely invested.
And it's even worse because there's this thing, a political scientist in the United States called Brendan Nyhan studied something called the backfire effect. And someone who's emotionally, what they call emotive reasoning or ideologically motivated reasoning, so take for an extreme example, take QAnon or Brexit or something like that, right? Providing them with facts strengthens their opposition. So wouldn't it be a lovely thing if people, call it QAnon, call it climate deniers and vaccine, whatever, whomever, pick your topic, right? Wouldn't it be nice if we could provide people with information and that would change their point of view, their ideology, and we're making it worse? We're exacerbating the differences of opinion that we have rather than coming closer together. That's wild, right? So yeah, not only does it not work, it might make the situation worse, which is an incredible thing to think about, right? We're getting it wrong.
It really completely undermines most people's view of human nature, that we are rational, logical, we are, we are persuadable. And the reality is we're not. And attempting to change people's minds, attempting to change people's attitudes by using facts, by using argument, is doomed to fail. But even if it somehow were to work and not make it worse, as you've pointed out, but even if it somehow did change their attitudes, that's got a very poor correlation with actually changing their behavior. And there's a huge amount of evidence that shows actually the causation runs the other way. That behavior changes and your attitude follows to try and keep up. And that then, of course, begs the question, well, how do you change behavior?
Yeah.
And the key finding of...
I didn't coin this, but you act your way into a new way of thinking.
Absolutely.
I wish that was me, but it's not. That's very clever. Yeah. Rather than think your way into a new way of acting, you act your way into a new way of thinking.
Absolutely.
And that's the shift.
And so much of our behavior, so many of our actions are shaped by factors in the environment, whether it's the social environment, other people, whether it's the way that information is presented, not the information itself, but the way that it's presented, the messenger. We pay much more attention to the messenger than the message. People who like Donald Trump, they're not really listening a lot of the time to what he's saying. They just like Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And they like what he's saying.
Yeah. Well, they don't care if it's truthful. They do like what he's saying, but they don't give a monkey's if it's true or not. And that's true, my side, perhaps your side also, I don't want to presume, side of the political fence. It's true also. He's famous for misrepresenting the truth, but no politician is known for strict adherence to the facts of the case, right? The old story about how do you know if they're lying, their lips are moving.
That's incredibly controversial. I can't believe you've gone there and suggested that some of our politicians might not be 100% honest all the time. That's a bridge too far.
Yeah. I put a picture of in a presentation and a keynote I gave of people who famously misrepresented the truth, and obviously Trump was on there too, but Clinton was much loved after he left. The highest rating of any president leaving office. I mean, he has 71% popularity rating or something like that when he left office, despite the shag that he had in the Oval Office with a young intern. God bless him. A very popular guy. But I was trying to think of a leader who would be associated with the notion of truthfulness and intellectual probity and honesty. And the only one I could think of was Jean-Luc Picard. That was the picture. This is some fantasy standard that we have for politicians, is that they'll tell us the truth. But anyway, so what do we do? So the question is, if I'm right and you're toiling away at the dawn of a new way of thinking about how we influence behaviors in organizations, and it should be easier in organizations than it is in society. We do have, we don't like to use it, but we do have a little more coercive power. There is this notion of shared behaviors and shared cultures. So, to what extent those are lip service, to what extent they're truthful, it should be easier to change behaviors in organizations than in the world writ large, I hypothesize. I could be wrong. What do you think? I don't know.
I fully agree. I think in an organization, you have a lot of levers you can pull. and not just the sort of the obvious ones, the traditional ones.
Yeah.
You've obviously got incentives, right? And I spent a portion of my career in banks, where obviously they're particularly attuned to one kind of incentive.
Yeah.
But it's not just about paying people more. Even reward, intangible reward, recognition is a really powerful driver of behavior. So if you change what's recognized, what's rewarded, over time that will shift behavior. You've got org structures and hierarchies. Yeah.
They're a captive audience, right? I mean, in the world writ larger, say it's anti-vaxxer, they can say, stick up your butt and leave me alone. And they've got the liberty to do that. You know, we would fight a war for their ability to tell us to stick up our butt, right? For freedom of conscience and, you know, liberty of determining what's best for you and your family. I mean, you know, there are limits to that. So, but in organizations, we don't accord people the same kind of political liberties that we do in things. They're there to, you know, some extent to toe the line. So we have a better shot at changing behaviors in organizations than outside organizations. It's a good laboratory for us to begin to do real experiments and try and get some of these things that I've written about in all of my books. I mean, this is the problem. Like, a lot of my books have this very kind of, there's a saying in, I think it was a Jesuit priest that told me, he says, you never piss on the altar. And he said, you know, here I am, I'm in the change management community, you know, arguably very well known as anyone is probably, but I spent a lot of time pissing on the altar saying, hey, a lot of this stuff's rubbish. Like, ADCAR is rubbish. ProSize stuff was born in the early 1990s. It was a reasonable stab at trying to create a formulaic approach to change that, as far as I can tell, hasn't improved in 30 years. So insofar as it was robust back in the day, which it wasn't terribly, but it was a start, it's certainly been proven by time to be, I have a robust obliteration of ADCAR and change myths. You'll enjoy it when you get to that chapter as well. I have like a 2-page, like, let's tear this apart once and forever. The example I use is, if you're a high school, if you've got a college student, or what they call freshman in America, first year student who's taking psychology, and one of the things they're studying is the drivers of human behavior. And one of the exam questions is, list 50 drivers of human behavior. I mean, you wouldn't have any trouble, right? There'd be all the internal stuff, and then there'd be all the external stuff, and then there'd be all the social stuff, and, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. And it wouldn't be that hard to come up with 50 things that influence human behavior. And some of those have been reduced to a smaller subset of things in models like COMB and TPB, theory of plan behavior. And, you know, let's leave over whether how accurate they are or how much of a simplification is useful. But what we know is that ADCAR is a very poor simplification. It's a really very poor simplification. And it relies upon knowledge, because it's based entirely on that paradigm. But if one of the drivers of a particular change was psychological safety, I said, where is that in ADCAR? I mean, if it's true, but let's assume for a moment that psychological safety is important, right? Where's that? I don't know. Where is environmental change, the stuff that we talk about, choice architecture or nudges or whatever you want to call it? Where's that? Like, it's just been, time has left that thing behind. But again, it's sunk costs. Because look at how many people who do the work that we do proudly display their ProSize certification front and center on their LinkedIn title. You know, the name, and then comma, one certification, comma, ProSize, comma, another certification. Like, that's a badge of honor. How do we change a world for where that's considered to be a badge of honor, which is, unfortunately, in my view, if I see that, I think this is someone who's not done enough homework and really gone into depth on the subject. I've just lost like 80% of your listeners. You know that, right? That's it. They're going to click the button. They're going to say bollocks to that guy. But anyway, yeah, that's my rant, and Ray, that's my rant.
So, Paul, having potentially lost 80% of the listeners, as you say, let's now attempt to get rid of the other 20% by talking about one other pervasive myth in not just organizational change, but organizations in general.
Yeah.
And I'm going to start with a simple question. What's your Myers-Briggs type, Paul?
I'm an TNF are close, P. And that means that I'm creative, inspirational, driven, visionary. I can't remember, but I mean, it's right up there next to Jesus if you read my profile. So, yeah, that's
a Libra.
I've got that and a Libra. So, yeah, so this is a fascinating thing. And again, you know, we're and sunk costs. So the Myers-Briggs website would say that 95% of organizations use the Myers-Briggs type indicator. I don't think they're wrong. I think they're probably right. And it's a tragedy. Do you want to know? I think you know this because you did a degree in this stuff. You know, there's something called the Forer effect. So the question is, like, when I said that I was going to debunk the Myers-Briggs thing, I put it on my Facebook page. I don't really use Facebook page. After 2016, I lost interest. But I said that I was going to, you know, have a go at the Myers-Briggs type indicator because I thought it was a bunch of rubbish. And a lot of people that I really like and are really buddies of mine said, I did it and it was life-changing. And I have respect for these people and affection for these people. So, you know, rather than saying, well, you're a loser, I said, why is that? And he said, it gave me a level of self-insight and, you know, about who I was in the world and how I was different from other people. And it helped me relate to other people better at work and outside work. And I thought, well, wow, that's really impressive. And they think they weren't bullshitting. That's sincerely what they think. There's something of the Forer effect, which is goes back to, I think, the 1940s and 50s, where a professor of psychology had a bunch of students, you know, call it 25 students, you know, freshmen sitting in his class. And he gave them a personality quiz. And, you know, he said, yeah, fill this out. And he took their answers and he, you know, scientized them, you know, he collated them and aggregated them and did all the sciencey stuff on them. And he played them back results, but he randomized. So he randomized the feedback, right? So the 25 students. So they weren't getting their feedback. They were getting some other guy's feedback. And people rated that like 4.6 out of 5 in accuracy. Which is the thing with astrology, and which is the thing with Myers-Briggs. There's so many of these things that we like to be told nice things about ourselves. And if they're general enough, we'll believe them. If they're general enough, we'll believe them and we'll like them and we'll find it valuable. And so there's that effect, the Forer effect, which is, I think, really interesting. But science left the Myers-Briggs type into, I mean, scientists didn't like, I mean, talking about scientists, like psychologists didn't like the MBTI from the start. Like from its birth, personality psychologists, many of them would say, this is a bunch of rubbish. And what's interesting is that one missing for it, Jung was a psychotherapist, right? And he used to see people who were neurotic. It's interesting to me that neuroticism is not one of his four dimensions. In fact, there's only one overlap between the Myers-Briggs type indicator and something that was much more robustly derived, which is the Big Five, which is extroversion. And the other three aren't in the Big Five, and four of the things that are in the Big Five aren't in the Myers-Briggs type indicator. And there's another one called Hexaco that's also sort of similarly in the same category of robust. And there's a lot of overlap between Hexaco and Big Five. Anyway, you know, science has left it behind. And Jung came up with his typology, if I remember correctly, in the 1930s. And it was seized upon by a woman who wasn't a professional psychologist called Isabel Myers-Briggs or Catherine Briggs, her mum. It was seized upon her. She was fascinated by human personality. It's a good thing to be fascinated by. She adopted Jung's hook, line, and sinker, and it took her daughter's marketing genius to turn it into an instrument that could be used. And then it was bought in the 1960s or 70s by a corporation who is, again, a genius at marketing this instrument. And so we have something that for 60 years has dominated the pop psychology landscape, which anybody who's a trained psychologist would say this is the most puerile rubbish. So anyway, that's Myers-Briggs. I mean, I think the thing I do in Change, Ms. James, is I have strong opinions. I mean, unfortunately, that's a character flaw, not an asset. And so I have my strong opinions on the things. And the very fact that they're in the book and I call them myths is, you know, a clue as to what I think of them. However, I do try to be balanced. I mean, I do try and say, using something from an Australian philosopher called Jennifer Duke Young, who's at Macquarie, where there's basically, if we know something about the world, there are four potential sources of knowledge. One is an authority figure. So Simon Sinek or John Kotter in Organizational Change or David Rock in Neuroscience, an authority figure. And authority figures are a great shortcut because you don't have to delve in the weeds and read 40 scientific papers. If you trust an authority figure, you can say, this guy's probably telling me the truth or some facsimile of the truth. So it's a very useful shortcut. The other one is intuition. And so in the Myers-Briggs type indicator and in learning styles and in the notion of resistance to change and in the notion of brains hate change and many of the myths in the book, they resonate with our intuitions, which is why they've been around, a lot of these things, for 60 years. Is they sort of make sense at a gut level. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, in some sense or another, resonates with people. And so intuition is another one. So we've got authority and intuition. And then we've got research evidence, which is the people who do the really hard work of trying to prove things true or false. And not much of us spend much time getting into the weeds on that. And then the other one is logic. And logic helps us, first of all, decide between which of these three we should be giving weight to. Is this a belief that I should be saying, oh, my intuition's probably more correct here, or I want to trust the research evidence, or you know what, I don't even want to bother with the research evidence because I trust this authority. But logic helps us kind of arbitrate between these different sorts. But it also tells us like things like, is this generalization true? They're generalizing from a particular instance to the general. So a difficult change to the fact that all change is difficult, for example, that would be a generalization. Is that apt? And also, we can parse people's use of language. Look, we use a lot of metaphors in change. Resistance to change is a metaphor, right? It comes to us from either physics or from political theory, depending on, you know, your taste. And a lot of these metaphors, you can't interrogate by asking whether they're true or false, because they ain't. And metaphors. If someone like Donald Trump says there's a tsunami of immigrants, you can't say, hang on, dude, there's no water, right? Because he's using a metaphor. And how big is a tsunami? And is this tsunami better than last year's tsunami? And how bigger is a tsunami than a typhoon or a trickle? You know, you can't, like, that's why they're, first of all, very powerful communication tools. And secondly, impossible to argue with, right? You can't really argue. But as the critical thinker, you have to say, what are the intentions of the metaphor user? Is the metaphor apt? Does it track reality in some sort of way? And so logic helps us. So those are the four kind of sources of knowledge. This is from epistemology, is logic, intuition, authority, and research. And so in each of the myths in the book, we go through each of these four things and parse the myth from those four angles, which frequently don't agree. But it's your job as a human being to decide where you place your, if I can use a $50 word, your epistemic chips. You know, you get to choose. That's your liberty. Do I want to trust Simon Sinek, or do I want to go into the weeds with research, or is my gut a more accurate determinant of the truth here? Or, you know, is this metaphor or generalization apt? And you get to choose. And as Tricia and I say in the book, we're not the Supreme Court. We'd love to be. But what we'd really love is to spark a debate inside the profession using some of these tools so that as a profession of 100,000 of us, because what I think doesn't make any difference, right? You know, but if we can begin to shift the mindset and the critical thinking, the way we approach the canon of organizational change, denial, anger, bargaining, acceptance, and learning styles and resistance to change. If we can begin to approach those in a critical way, I'm not saying like we're going to throw them all out. And good God, maybe wrong about some of these, right? You know, entirely possible, right? Likely, some would say. But we need to, I think, as a profession, engage with these things in a more critical way. So that's the tool that's in the book that runs through all of the myths in the book. And I think that's not just useful for change. It's useful for fake news, and it's used for political rhetoric and political speech. It's used for medicine and supplements. We are besieged by, you know, medical cure-alls, the bleach cures, you know. So, I mean, anyway, I think this kind of, in the information age that we live in, the ability to parse information and make sense of it using your critical thinking, I think is a superpower. It's an essential thing, because we're deluged by information every day, and some of it's of very mixed quality, and we need to be able to see through the bullshit. And you know, we need to take what the contents of our heads, like, we need to treat that preciously. Like, my beliefs are important. And it's important insofar as I can make them robust, to make them robust. So that's the kind of aim of the book, if I may be grandiose and noble sounding. Anyway, what do you think of that?
Well, I think it's a very noble aim. And I haven't actually read the book. My copy hasn't yet arrived over here in Australia. It is on the way. But I think this conversation certainly achieves that aim, right? It sparks a debate. And hopefully our listeners will engage with that debate and will take it with them and try and engage others in it as well.
Should we spend 1 minute on the book that you and I are writing together?
Yeah, why don't we talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, and this probably should be our footnote, but so one criticism of change myths is that, all right, all this stuff's rubbish, but what do I do instead? All right, big guy, say I buy your bullshit, and I agree that a lot of these things are myths. What do I replace them with? Oh, and by the way, you know, you're very good at tearing things down. Wouldn't it be nice if you were good at creating things as well, big guy? So, I mean, I'm a fair cop, you know, governor. You know, I think that's a fair criticism. And so the book that James and I are going to toil on together is called The Future of Change Management. And right now I'm picturing 10 chapters. James will be an author of one of them on behavioral science and culture change. But there are some new areas that I don't think are sufficiently in the change canon yet. So one of them is diversity and inclusion. So the last 40 years since the change world has born, would have been a sort of, you could call it a revolution, a seismic revolution in the way we think about inclusion in organizations. How does that inform it? How does neurodiversity inform it? How does mental health and trauma afford how we think about change? How does gamification affect how we do change? What else is in there? How chatbots, are they going to affect the change management world? Are they going to put us all out of a job? What do we think about that? So those 10 essays, 2,500 words, by in your case, about 5,000 words. but those essays are, I think, going to be the only collection that I can think of trying to pull together the stuff that's sort of on the frontier or on the fringes of change management. And, you know, it's up for the practitioner to decide, yeah, you know, wow, diversity and inclusion. You know, I'm used to chopping the world into roles and functions when I do stakeholder mapping. Do I need to think about the way it affects non-white people versus white people, or women versus men, or old people versus young people, or virtual workers versus remote workers? How do I begin to think about in a more robust way the differences between the people that I'm trying to influence and change? So I think these are unanswered questions. I haven't seen any great answers to them. So we've got a collection of 10 authors. James is one. I'm going to step out and provide like an editorial support function, but I'm hoping it'll be a great book. And I think it might be, I don't know. You know, you always have to, if you're starting a business or starting a book, you always have to deceive yourself that this could be the one. Self-deception. Yeah. So anyway, that's the project James and I are working on, listeners. So if you grab a copy of Change Myths and let me know what you think, Paul at paulgibbons.net. And if you don't like change myths, hopefully by the end of the year, James and I will come up with something that you may like.
Thank you, Paul. That was wonderful, as always. I hope our listeners enjoyed that.
Yeah, I hope they enjoyed it too. I hope they enjoyed it too. Thanks for having me.
It's been 2,500 years since the Greek philosopher Heraclitus famously pronounced, "The only constant in life is change." But it's a statement that's never been truer than it is today. The pace of change, technological, societal, geopolitical, has never been greater. How organizations deal with change
is of critical importance. In a world changing as rapidly as ours, it's probably the single biggest determinant of whether organizations will succeed or fail. It would seem fairly important then that approaches to this have a solid basis, but it's very evident from that conversation with Paul that a lot of the time, it's simply not the case. And it's frankly scandalous that so much of organizations' approach to change and to leadership, learning, and so many other human elements hangs on such dubious assumptions. There's a great irony here. This is a podcast that episode after episode talks to experts in the behavioral sciences about how humans aren't the perfectly rational creatures beloved of the economics textbooks, about how humans are creatures of habit, prone to numerous biases, how much behavior is driven by social norms, and how we're suckers for a good story or a credible, confident-sounding expert. And all these tendencies explain why so much of organizational change, frankly, so much of HR, is built on the kind of myths that Paul demolished in today's conversation. We've always done it this way. Everybody does it like this. The big names recommend it. The challenge is to move beyond these comfortable, familiar myths and try new approaches grounded in science. Let's leave Kubler-Ross where she belongs, back in the summer of 69. You've been listening to The B-Word, a podcast produced by Izzy Rackage and presented by me, James Healy.